Just start it off, if you could just state your name and spell it for us and give us your date of birth.
Jim Foley, F-O-L-E-Y. My date of birth is 53.
And you were born in Helena, is that right?
I was born and raised in Helena, as most of my family was. As I've mentioned before, my mother was an O'Neill with two L's, who was born and raised in Butte and Dublin Gulch. Mm-hmm. In the Hub Edition, and my father was born and raised in Anaconda.
Okay. And what is, starting with your mother, what is her kind of family background? How is she connected?
Well, she would be, her parents, Annie and Danny O'Neill, came over from Ireland. So she would be the next generation, and I'd be the one after that. Mm-hmm. And they came over here, you know, initially to be, service staff in, her mother was service staff in a, Monsignor's, in the priest's home at the Catholic Church, and her father was kind of a grunt in the mines at the, when they first came. So that's how they initially came over here.
And do you know anything about their conditions in Ireland before they came over?
You know, I don't know much about their conditions in Ireland, but I do know the family still has the family home over there. It's obviously second, third kinds of cousins that still live there. Mm-hmm. But I think they had some challenges in terms of being able to make a living. And they had heard, obviously, that there was opportunities in America and made their way over here like other Irish that came to this country.
Now, does anybody in your family kind of track that lineage at all? Do you know if any paper?
You know, my older sister, Kathleen, has tracked a little bit of it, but it's mainly kind of where they came from in Ireland and Cork, to get it more specifically, mm-hmm. Because they obviously started before the home they're in now. And so my sister has done it, but not at any great length, no.
Okay. And how about your father's side in Anaconda?
Well, interestingly enough, my father, and we didn't have the opportunity to chat about this the other day, but my father's lineage he was adopted by the Foley family, but he was born into a family by the name of Mulvihill, which is also from County Cork, and somehow they got abandoned. I've never really quite figured that out. My father didn't talk about it much, and always considered him a Foley, but he enjoyed his time in Anaconda.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what kind of family do you still have, or what kind of connections do you have with Montana as far as family here?
Well, I still have multiple cousins in Butte. I don't really have that much family in still located in Anaconda, but I have family in Butte. I have family in the Bitterroot. Family in Kalispell, and still some a brother and a sister who still live in Helena. But it's pretty spread out. It really is.
Sure. Are you married?
I am married to Julie Hassler Foley. She's not Irish. She grew up in St. Louis, but she's familiar and comfortable with both the tradition and the loyalty that the Irish have to one another.
Okay. Well, do you have any children?
We do not have any children.
Okay. How would you, how would you describe that loyalty and that connection to Ireland in kind of a general sense?
You know, it's an interesting thing, and every generation is probably slightly different, but I don't think this part is different. I think a lot of it was faith-based. And, going through Catholic schools at the time in Montana, there were more in Montana at the time in the 60s and 70s and early 80s, and we understood about sticking together as a family, sticking together with our cousins and our aunts and uncles. And that's still prevalent to this day. And I still think that has a lot to do with how the Irish stayed together, not only in Butte and Anaconda and Missoula, but in Billings and Kalispell and Helena. I mean, they always stuck together because of the faith base and how we grew up in Catholic schools. And I don't know that that's much that much different today. It may not be faith-based with schools, but I still think it has to do with the church. I really do.
Mm-hmm. And what's your experience growing up with the church?
Well, you know, I was of the age that I went to Catholic grade school. In high school, I went to the first 2 years of a Catholic high school, and then it shut down in Helena, and then I went to the public school. And then I went to a private Catholic university, St. John's University, as my brother did. And my older sister went to Gonzaga, which is a Jesuit school in Spokane. It was always there and prevalent, but our parents always let us make that choice. So it was always connected in some way.
Okay. How did you, excuse me. What was it like to go from an all-Catholic school to like bust into public school for you?
You know, I have to tell you, it was actually a very scary experience. And I mean this with a great deal of respect. I'm not sure I'd be where I'm at today had I not gone to the public school, because it had more diversity in a variety of ways. It had more classes available for folks who were average students, which I was. And it had the capacity to have more advisors and counselors to kind of help you get through the process. And I really do attribute to my ability to get into St. John's and some other things because I was able to meet more friends and diversify a little bit and get to know folks in Helena in a different way. And many of those kids, both from the Catholic school and from public school, are my friends today. I stay in touch with them. And it's not overwhelming, but they're still friends and they're still loyal. And, you know, at the time, it was scary, though, I can tell you. I mean, many of us were going into that like, oh, my gosh, we have to go to a public school, whatever that is. And yet, I think it worked out for the better for the vast majority. I really do.
Yeah, cool. What? How does Catholicism play in your life now?
You know, I mean, I still have great faith. I'm not sure that that going to church every day, like it was when I was growing up, is as critical for me. But I still have great faith and still have... You know, I'm still active in the Catholic Church at a small level, certainly not very much because of the life I lead now, and I'm traveling a lot, but it still plays a role in my life, and it still plays a role in my family's life. We don't talk about it much, and it's not, you know, as ingrained in us as it was when we were growing up, but it still plays a critical role in who we are and how we operate and how we move forward in terms of interacting with others, not just our family, but others in the community and the state.
Sure, great. How was growing up in Helena? As a kid, well,
you know, I mean, I think, I mean, my cousins would always refer to the cousins in Helena as those pencil-necked Helena kids. But, you know, I think it was a great place to grow up. I mean, we grew up in a neighborhood right in front of the Capitol. You know, we still know people in that neighborhood today that have come back. Some of those families have. I just went to a birthday party in Hamilton for a woman who babysat us when we were growing up, who turned 100, I mean, a century old in Hamilton the other day. I mean, so it was a neighborhood, but we spent an enormous amount of time going back and forth to Butte and Anaconda, going to Butte to the Columbia Gardens, which people are familiar with, going to Anaconda to, you know, what is now Kennedy Park, skating and spending the winter where my grandparents on my dad's side lived. So, I mean, it was an interesting life. It really was. And in my parents' world, as we've chatted about before, they were really never from Helena. They were always from Butte or from Anaconda. They happened to live in Helena, and they made that very clear. But it was a great place to grow up. It really was.
That's good. Tell me about Columbia Gardens.
You know, Columbia Gardens was even in our world, when we were living in Helena, when we'd go over there for holidays, 4th of July, or picnics in the summer, was a magical place. It really, truly was. And while there were carnivals and other things that went on around the state that we might see, it was never quite like the gardens where the flowers were fresh, the grass was always green and cut, everything was picked up, and you saw a lot of families gather there that may have not have been able to afford to do other things. It was always magical. I think frankly, in our generation, though, we may have taken it for granted because it was a place that we would go and get on the roller coaster and go on the horses and go in the arcade area and... But it was still a magical place. It was still, you came into an oasis when you showed up there. And to this day, I mean, I'll drive into Butte from the Helena way, not from Deer Lodge and back that way, and I'll still see where the gardens, at least part of it was before the pit expanded. And it brings back really fond memories. It really, truly does. But I think in our generation, it was, I think we, in an odd way, took it for granted. But I'm telling you, it was a magical place. It really was. It was just... So it's kind of an out-of-body experience for us.
Do you have any really specific memories of it? Anything that jumps into mind?
You know, my specific memory was, which is probably lots of others, particularly kids who grew up in Butte, you know, getting on the roller coaster and thinking, you know, this dadgum thing is older than dirt. It's wood, and something's going to happen, and then it would just go away once you got on it. But that really is the only memory I really have of it. And then the arcade part, because... you know, of the various candies. And, you know, my parents would talk about going to dances over there at Columbia Gardens when they were growing up and dating. And they had all the big bands, you know, that were long gone by the time our generation came along, Benny Goodman and those kinds of bands. But, you know, that was all foreign to us. That didn't mean anything to us in our generation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You talked about going into Butte for, like, family get-togethers and stuff. Right. What would something like that be like? Let's say 4th of July in Butte with the family.
You know, we would always go to We would always go to my aunt and uncle's house, which is no longer there because the pit expanded and took that part. So they now live, their families now live out in the flats of Butte. We'd go to their house first, and if we weren't going to the gardens, there was a typical Butte thing that was always humorous to those of us from Helena, where you would sit in the kitchen. You seldom sat in the front room. They would want to know if you ate anything yet. You know, they'd say, "Gee, yet?" And they would always say, and I'm not sure what this meant at the time. It took us a while to figure this out. How long are you going to stay around? How long are you here for? You know, we always took it for, well, they want to know if we're going to be here overnight. Later on in life, I always took it for, you're not going to stay around a long time, are you? Because we got to get out of here. And then we would go to the gardens together. And generally, my mother and her sisters and her brother, you know, who lived in Butte at the time, would make picnics, and we would go out there and, you know, do all the free things where you wouldn't have to go pay on the rides and get something to eat and then go on the rides. But, you know, it was, again, it was a magical time. But I think we sort of took it for granted that it was a holiday to go over there and go to Columbia Gardens and go downtown, what we call Uptown Butte now. But we were always foreigners. I mean, they always referred to us as those Helena cousins. And I'm not sure I blame them, but, you know. And by the way, the other thing we always did, which is not unusual, is my mother would always dress us up. And as young kids, you know, going to Butte, I mean, my cousins in Butte would look at us like, you know, who the heck are these Helena guys? Are all dressed up. Not in suits, but we would be in nice pants and, you know, a nice shirt. And they'd come out and, you know, beat the daylights out of us because we were coming over from Helena and slightly different in ages. But my mother was always adamant about, no, you're going to look nice when you go to Butte. I mean, it was an absolute critical thing to her.
What other kind of holidays did you spend maybe outside the gardens?
You know, we didn't. We would go over there on occasion for Thanksgiving, not much for Christmas, on occasion for some birthdays or anniversaries. And as we got older, you know, kids were out doing their own things and it went away a little bit. But I don't think we ever got away from at least a time or two in the summer to go to the gardens, no matter what our age was. And then with Anaconda, with my dad's parents, you know, they would always come to us for Christmas and those kinds of things. We didn't spend as much time in Anaconda growing up. Although when we got into high school and athletics, we would go over there and, you know, in sports teams, and we would always show up and spend time with my grandma and grandpa and any relatives I had in Butte or in Anaconda at the time.
Mm-hmm. Was there any particular, like, Irish stuff? Did you get together for St. Patrick's Day or?
You know, it's an interesting thing. I don't know that we got together for St. Patrick's Day until we were much older. And not because of adult beverages, by the way. It was just we became to value it a heck of a lot more. And I know some of my family still go there for St. Patrick's Day, fly in and meet my cousins. And I have no intention of going back there on St. Patrick's Day. It's too interesting, too wild. But, you know, it didn't really occur to us to do that on St. Patrick's Day until later in life. And in my world, I used to go there, you know, as an adult working when I was working for elected officials for parades on St. Patrick's Day or 4th of July, and it was work. So I always want to avoid going there because it reminds me a little bit of working for the people I had the opportunity to work for.
Right. Okay. Tell me about your mom and how she looked at the world.
You know, my mom was she had five kids. It was, you know, when you talk about my mother, it was difficult for her to leave Butte. She was the first one of her family to leave Butte shortly after my mom and dad got married, and they moved to Helena because my dad was finishing up at Carroll College. You know, they lived in subsidized housing. They may have had two kids very quickly after they were married. I came along later, 4 or 5 years later. It was very difficult for her. And I, you know, she interacted with her family quite a bit back in Butte when she lived in Helena, but you know, with technology, it wasn't the same. I mean, two of my aunts didn't have phones in their house, didn't have landlines. One of my aunt and uncle who worked in the mines didn't have a car. And so it was always the burden for us, although we didn't view it as a burden really, to go to Butte to see them. And so communication was via letters or through other means. But she never really considered herself much out of Butte. She really, truly didn't. And a story that you and I talked about previously the other day, I mean, I had the opportunity to work for Congressman Williams, who was born and raised in Butte as well, when he was a member of Congress. And one time my mom and dad were out there, it was like the late 80s, I think, and I took them to the house dining room, in which the food is, in my judgment, interesting. But anyway, they wanted to go to the house dining room so they could see a few folks. And at the time, the speaker was Congressman Tip O'Neill from Massachusetts. And he, being the nice fellow he was, came over to the table. He didn't really know who I was. He just knew who I worked for. And, you know, I introduced him to my mom and dad, and they chatted about my mom's maiden name of O'Neill and Tip O'Neill. They chatted about that a little bit. And I'll never forget this. We left the dining room that day and went out to the halls of the Capitol. And my mother had said to Tip earlier, when he asked her where she was from, she said, you know, I'm from Butte, but I happen to live in Helena. And really, we went in the halls, and I said, really, Mom, I don't get it. I mean, you raised 5 kids in Helena. You've lived in Helena almost 50 years. And she stopped in the halls of the Capitol and said, yeah, but I'm not from Helena. I'm from Butte. That's where I'm always from. And it wasn't done in a way of lecturing me. It was done she felt good about the place she grew up. And she never forgot where she came from or how she got to where she is, never. And she instilled that in us as well.
Mm-hmm. What else, what other kind of ways did your mom's kind of loyalty come out?
Well, she, you know, she still had great aunts in Ireland, for example, that are still in the family home at the time we were growing up. So they would communicate at Christmas, and she would always try to tell us about Ireland and about Butte. You know, one of the things that's interesting in this, during this documentary, I'm sure you'll hear this a little bit, every once in a while when we were growing up, we would be critical of the company, the Anaconda Company, or the Butte Water Company, or which was owned by the Anaconda Company. And she would never really allow us to do that, because she understood, while they had some challenges, that it put food on the table. It gave them a house to live in. It gave us an opportunity to survive. Not in our generation, but in her generation. And she was always very careful about that. Her father, Danny O'Neill, was also the head of the Ancient Order of Hibernians in Butte for a while. I'm not sure the time frame, because it's always a little unclear. Mm-hmm. And he was always very clear about, in the mines he worked in as a supervisor, which he finally got to, he was only going to hire Irish. And, you know, in today's world, people would look at that and that would be completely foreign and we'd have lawsuits. But in that time, that was common. And not common just with the Irish. But I think the Irish were a little bit more loyal to their friends and cousins and who came from Ireland. And he was always very clear about, in the writings he had back to my mother, that he was only hiring Irish.
Interesting. Why do you think that that's... why do you think that he was so strong with his connection with the Irish?
You know, I really do believe that he came, like many other Irish that came to Montana, and not just to Butte, he came with nothing. And he understood that he wanted to help the next generation, you know, be part of having a house and having food and things like that. And as a matter of fact, you know, my uncle Danny O'Neill, it did create problems for him, because during a couple of the strikes, long before, you know, my generation ever came along, he didn't cross the picket line. And he lost his job a couple of times as a result of that, and had windows broken in his house. And but I think at the end of the day, he just wanted to be loyal to the folks who helped him out. And in his world, that was the Irish world. And I'm not sure he knew any different. I mean, again, he lived in, you know, what was Dublin Gulch and the Hub Edition. And so that's all he knew when he went home at night. And so he wanted to hire the next generation of people coming up. And he made it clear in his writings back to my mother that that's what he was going to do.
That's interesting. We talked a little bit earlier, maybe we can just kind of review kind of what what your own personal connections with your Irishness are, or maybe where that's kind of gotten you, or what kind of connections you've had professionally even.
You know, I think, I mean, I've had wonderful opportunities, not only when I worked for elected officials, Senator Baucus, Congressman Williams, you know, interacting with ambassadors from Ireland, both on the U.S. side and the Irish side a little bit, you know, being at the Irish Embassy in Washington. But I think since I've been at the university, you know, when I first came back here within a couple of years, the president of Ireland, Mary McAleese, came over here because she wanted to see what was going on with the Irish Studies program. And I had the opportunity to have lunch with her along with about 15 others. And I mean, she knew all about Cork. She knew all about Butte. I mean, she obviously had done her homework. And, you know, frankly, that was heartening to somebody like me, because it brought home about how important your heritage is. And maybe not just in the Irish world, but in my world, it was important. And to hear her talk that day on campus here in a public forum about the value of Butte and what it meant, not just to this country, but to Ireland to this day, and the value of Anaconda and the value of the Irish that came over here. I mean, that was heartwarming. It really, truly was. And, you know, we have the Irish Studies program here, which I think has been a tremendous asset, but it's not just the language or the history, I mean, it's also the dance and, you know, other things. And it's not just Missoula or the university, it's this state. And so I think reminders like that, the older you get, you become maybe a little melancholy, but I don't think you should forget kind of who you are and how you were raised and the issues that made you who you are, whether it be successful or mildly successful. And I can tell you, because of my relationship in the Irish world, when I first got out of college and started into politics, it helped me. I mean, Pat Williams, Congressman Williams, didn't know me from a hole in the wall. He knew my parents, and he knew I was interested in politics. That's how I got into it. That's precisely how I got into it. And so those relationships in the Irish world still matter to this day. And I, you know, I'm very proud of it. I really am. I think as you get older, you get to a point where you are proud of it. You do talk about it. You do read Irish literature. You do read Irish history. And every once in a while in Irish history, even to this day, I'll uncover things that are either directly or indirectly to my family. And it's not a lot. I don't want to overstate it. But it's still out there in the Irish history books, in Montana history books in Montana. And that, you know what? That's pretty cool. That's heartwarming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not a lot of people have that opportunity.
No.
So do you think growing up right at the base of the Capitol got you into politics more?
Well, I actually...
What drove you to politics?
I got into politics because I needed a job when I got out of undergrad and graduate school. And I went to work for, at the time, the governor as a minion. I mean, totally a gopher. And I loved it. And then I also grew up next door to former Senator Lee Metcalf, who I didn't really know what he did when I was growing up until I got older, that he was a member of the Congress, a member of the U.S. Senate. And so I did a couple of internships in his office, and, you know, it took off. It's addicting. And by the way, I think in the Irish world, you know, politics and public service, we have always used those as honorable things. We have never viewed them as anything but honorable. I mean, the Kennedys made it honorable. Other people in elected office said, look, government and what you do in public service matters, but it's an honorable profession, and treat it that way. And I actually think the Irish still embrace that to this day. I mean, just last week, I had the opportunity to go back to the Irish embassy and chat with a number of folks, and most of them were elected officials from around the country, and they understood public service and why it was honorable. They did understand it. They weren't always in public service. So I think it was a good lesson growing up.
Mm-hmm. Great. Tell me about your time in Washington, some of the kind of things you got to get into over there.
Well, you know, I went back to Washington in Washington, D.C. in 1984, working for Congressman Williams as a legislative assistant. I ended up leaving his staff in 1997 when he retired as his staff director. And, you know, it was a wonderful experience. I got to meet lots of folks. I got to be involved with lots of issues that were important to this country and to this state. Congressman Williams obviously has his own background with Irish heritage and the candy store, the American candy store that his mother and father owned, which my parents went to. I mean, it's a small world. You know, in the staff, there were a number of us who were, I'm not sure if it was coincidence or conscious on Congressman Williams' part, but we were Irish. I mean, there was a Flanagan, a Foley, a Noonan, a McAlpin. I never did get the answer, but there were a lot of Irish on his staff, both in Montana and in Washington, D.C. But, you know, I had great opportunities to be involved in historical events that to this day I look back and feel lucky. I really do. I mean, following that, I came back to Montana for a little bit and then went to work for Senator Baucus as his Montana chief of staff and traveled around the state and the country with Senator Baucus. You know, went through a couple of re-election campaigns with him. Because his committee has jurisdiction over trade issues, traveled around the world, you know, went to Australia, New Zealand, China, Japan, Cuba, Thailand, had wonderful opportunities, Panama, all in the interest of trying to, you know, put together trade agreements with other staff. Mm-hmm. So I feel very lucky, I really do. You know, coming back here to the University of Montana, I got to come back to Montana, which I wasn't sure I'd ever do that, but it worked out good. It really did.
Great. You talked about some kind of these historic things that you got to kind of just be almost around for, or at least play some part in. What can you give me a couple examples of those?
Well, you know, I got to have the opportunity to go through a couple of inaugurations with President Bush the first. You know, sitting on the steps of the Capitol, watching this be done, I got to see the inauguration of President Clinton twice. And you know what? If you think about that, it's historic. And, you know, I had a front row seat. I never thought I'd see the day I'd do that. I mean, had opportunities to fly around the country and around the world with these officials. Been in the White House.
Excuse me.
Been in the White House, a number of times as a staff. Worked on healthcare issues, worked on minimum wage issues. Worked on public lands and national parks issues that related to Montana and the country with lots of other staff. It wasn't just me. I mean, those are pretty important things. And I look back now at kind of what folks did together because of who we worked for, in my case, Congressman Williams and Senator Baucus, it made a difference in people's lives. And, you know, in my world, that's a pretty neat thing. I appreciate that. And by the way, I don't think that's unique to the Irish, but I think the Irish take it more serious in this regard, in that public service is something you need to go do at some point in your life, whether or not you're going to do it full time or not. You need to go do it. And it's an obligation. And I think maybe that's how I was raised, but I think in the Irish world, I think it was something that was talked about a fair amount.
Do you know, would you tell me insight about maybe why?
I just think because they understood it was a duty, much like we see today in today's world about community service. You know, go out and help Habitat for Humanity, go out and help the YMCA, go out and... And while that was still relevant then, I think public service was different. And it was viewed different then. So to be involved was an important thing for you to do, to give back. And I think it's still the case. I mean, I still think it's an honorable profession, but in the Irish world, I think that was ingrained in your head. You know, take an opportunity to give back, be involved in public service at some level. Government's a good thing. It's not a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. Now, you got a chance to actually go to Ireland on a few of these trips. Is that right?
I had that chance to go to Ireland, never to see my relatives with the Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, and some others, but it was always really business. And, you know, we would go from the airport to the embassy and do business. But I got the opportunity to spend some time, a little time in Dublin, a little time in Shannon. But I've never been to my family homestead. I intend to do that one of these days. Everybody else in my family, I think, has done it, except for one other person, one other brother. So it was magical to see. It really was.
But I guess what were some of your impressions? I mean, getting off the plane for the first time.
Well, you know, it's emotional. Because if you think about it, and I'm not unique in this regard, you know, that's where we came from. So it's emotional to get off and to see this country that, you know, in our case, Montana could envelop two or three times. And that's where you came from. That's where your grandparents came from in some capacity. So it's kind of emotional. And everybody has a different view of it. I would guess that, you know, someday when I go to the family homestead, it'll probably overwhelm me just because I'll know that's where the family came from. But it was emotional. And you keep that internal, but, you know, it really, the hair on the back of my neck stood up and, you know, you tear up a little bit and everybody's different. But it was very emotional. I mean, it's personal, so it's emotional to you.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I'm going to shift in gears here a little bit. How did your folks meet? Do you know, you mentioned some dances and stuff, but do you know?
You know, I've heard a couple of different scenarios, and they're now passed away, both of them, so I'll never be able to verify it. But they met, you know, in Butte at some dances. My mother was a young woman who went to Butte Central. Girls Central is what they called it at the time. And my father was a young man who went to Anaconda Central in Anaconda. You know, he worked in the smelter for a while and realized he didn't want to do that forever, so he went to Carroll. I mean, he hitchhiked over to Helen to go to Carroll College. And it's my understanding they met in some social settings and began to date a little bit. I can tell you that my grandparents, when I knew them when I was very little, didn't really like that my mother was dating somebody or seeing somebody from Anaconda. It really wasn't the right thing. In fact, they made my father sit out on the porch. They wouldn't let him come inside the house, which probably isn't unusual. And I think when they got married, they knew that they were going to move to Helena because my father had to finish Carroll College. He was in there, went to the war, then had to go back. And they were upset for a long time when he took my mother out of Butte. But I think they met in a social setting, you know, over in Butte because it was only a few miles from Helena and only a few miles from Anaconda. But I don't know exactly the circumstances.
Sounds like your father was a pretty go-to kind of guy.
He was part of the Irish Mafia in Helena, I think. For a long time, I didn't know what in the hell he did for a living. But he was in insurance, and he was involved in city council and was the mayor of Helena for a little while. Active in terms of helping out Carroll College with their sports and athletic hall of fame. And I mean, he loved Helena, but he never really was from Helena. Mm-hmm. He stayed close to his buddies from Anaconda.
Right, and so you say, so he was born in Anaconda, and yeah. Then, could you just kind of talk about maybe his kind of start to finish run?
You know, he was interesting, and people that know him will may not know this, but he had polio when he was a young child, so he always had one side of his body was slightly smaller and weaker all through his whole life. And I don't know what went on with polio at that time or what kind of vaccines they had at the time, but he had some challenges. But it was active in athletics. He and Archbishop Hunhausen, who's still alive today, you know, grew up together for a while, lived together in Anaconda, were good friends. They had nicknames for one another. You know, Dutch Hunhausen was the Archbishop's name, and my father's name was Fog Foley. I don't know what that means, actually, but I draw my own conclusions. But, you know, he had an upbringing where he didn't have a lot of money, just like anybody else. Went to work in the smelter at holidays and breaks. You know, realized after a while, after high school, that he wanted to do something more than shovel steel balls as a laborer, and hitchhiked, as I said, to Carroll College and went to school. Left and went into service in the early 40s, you know, for a couple of years, and then came back. He wasn't married at the time, then came back and finished Carroll and got married and stayed in Helena.
What kind of
got a degree in zoology, of all things, at Carroll College. Now, what the hell he was going to do with that, I have no idea. And he probably didn't either.
That's actually kind of funny. What was your connection with him growing up? Was he president around a lot, or is he
going to swap out cards?
You're going to swap out cards?
Yeah, thanks.
Okay. Yeah, we can take a pause then.
Love these presidential debates. Mm-hmm. Just tear each other's hide off.
Yeah. Wouldn't want it to be civil.
You know, my dear friend and colleague, I'm about to tear your hide off.
Yeah.
How they start it.
Exactly. So what was your relationship with your father growing up?
You know, I think, I mean, in our family, we had five kids, and I was the middle, and I was named after my father, but I wasn't a junior. Mm-hmm. He was very careful to give me a different middle name. And he told me later in life that, you know, he thought the junior thing was just overrated. And, you know, I don't know what he meant by that. To this day, people think I'm Jim Jr., Jim Foley Jr. I'm really not. But he was a unique guy. He worked hard, you know, was involved in a number of different committees and hospital boards and things like that growing up. I don't recall that he ever missed a sporting event of any of us. A speech debate with any of us. I don't recall that he ever did. But he never was one to tell us where we ought to be in life or what we ought to become. He really did allow us to get there on our own and guide us. But he had a different relationship with all of us. With me, I think just because I was his namesake, per se, he was always careful. In the middle child, he was always careful to push me a little harder. That's my view. He was probably right. You know, I was probably a knucklehead most of my grade school and early high school, but he always treated each other differently, but it was always respectfully in terms of how he loved all of us. I mean, it just was always different. He always had a different relationship with all of us.
And how about your siblings? What kind of relationship do you have with them?
You know, we're still close to this day. You know, I have a younger sister who lives in Helena. I have a younger brother who lives in Helena. I have an older brother who lives in Boulder, Colorado. An older sister who lives in Yakima, Washington. But we're still close to this day. We probably talk to one another at least once a week, which I think is a little unusual. And most of it is just kind of family business or checking in. Now that my parents have passed away, but I think we're pretty close. Geographically, we're split up, but you know, my brother and sister come to the Grizz games, every home game. One from Yakima, one from Helena. I don't know how they do it, but you know, they're always seeking tickets. Always want freebies. But I still think we're close today. I really do.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Music is oftentimes a big part of, you know, the Irish household. Did you have any kind of history with that at all?
You know, I didn't. I mean, music I grew up with was more big band music that my mother and father loved. I don't recall much Irish music or language being in our house much at all. I don't know there was any reason for that. It just didn't come up a lot. I just don't recall much of it except the big band music and things like, I mean, they always had music going, but it wasn't Irish music much. Mm-hmm. It really wasn't. Sure. I don't know if they didn't like it or what, I'm not sure. Or it was depressing to them, or I'm not really sure, but it never really was in our household much.
Okay. If your folks are anything like mine, my mom tells the same story a thousand times about her folks or her siblings.
Oh, God, yeah.
Or, is there any of those stories that really kind of come to mind as the go-to story for your mom? Or your dad, actually.
You know, I think the one story that I always used to hear about that came out all the time, I was always pretty close to being the same, is I had an uncle, Gerald, and his last name was Driscoll. My grandmother was married before she married Danny O'Neill in Ireland, and her husband passed away over there. And so she had a son, Gerald Driscoll, who came over to Butte quite a number of years after they had come to Butte initially and started to have my mother and her siblings. And Gerald came over and became a fireman. And Gerald, I remember this even growing up, although he died when I was probably maybe 8 or 9 or 10 in that vicinity of cancer. Gerald had a drinking issue. And he would go on binges, and he would, you know, work as a fireman for a few days and then go on a binge. And then he wouldn't drink for 6 months, and then he would go on another binge. And one night, this is a story my mother and father used to always tell. My mother in particular would tell it because she experienced it, is he got into a little brawl with the police who came to get him, and it included, at the time, the chief of police. And they put him in jail, and I don't know exactly what happened, but so I don't want to blame the police here, but he got beat up pretty good, and he was a big guy, about 6'5", about 220. And months and months after that, as the story gets told, the chief of police's car caught on fire. And it was one of those really small kind of engine fires that maybe at the time with those kinds of cars started. And my Uncle Gerald was on duty at the time and showed up with a truck, got called and showed up. And the story goes that as he got out of the truck and realized whose car it was, he remembered that the chief of police and his officers had taken him down and given him a little whipping some months earlier. And so what could have been done with a fire hose simply just put out this engine fire, my Uncle Gerald took out an axe and took it to the car and chopped it up pretty good, and the fire got put out. And really, to the day my mother and father died, they swore that was an accurate story. And I've never had anybody verify it, but as I think about my Uncle Gerald and his time in Butte, because he'd go on these binges, and he was pretty ugly when he'd go on these binges, it's probably accurate. And since then, I've always tried to verify it with some of the old firemen over there, and I've never really been able to do it. But it sounds, you know, at that time, in the 30s and 40s and 50s, sounds plausible. It wouldn't go on today, but in those times, it was plausible.
Sure.
He probably got away with it.
Probably. What was your house like in Helena growing up?
You know, when we were growing up, when my mother and father first came to Helena, my father was in Carroll College finishing up. They lived in what was called the Stewart Homes, which was subsidized housing down in what's called the 6th Ward District in Helena. And when they got out of that and my father got a job, it may have been in a gas station at the time, they moved to a place called Benton Avenue, which was up near the Civic Center, up near Carroll College. And it was a duplex, and you know, they had one side and another family had another side, which is still there today. And then when I was born, shortly after I was born, about a year later, my father ended up purchasing a house over in front of the Capitol that my brother still lives in and owns, my little brother. And it was a magical place, as I've said before, in a neighborhood where everybody got to know one another. Times were different, I know that, but nobody worried about checking in or anything like that. Everybody always knew where everybody was in the neighborhood. But it allowed me some opportunities to make friends, lifelong friends. And we've kept the house in the family. When my mother and father passed away, we gave it to my little brother, and he's maintained it, maintained the same colors and everything. And it's still pretty cool to go back and know that that's still in the family. And I think my mother and father bought that home in 1955 for $15,000. I haven't a clue where they got that money, because he didn't have any money. And then he and my mother had two more children, and we were all raised in that house. So it was pretty nice.
Yeah. What was a like an average Saturday for you as a kid? Do you remember any kind of...
You know, an average Saturday that I remember growing up was my father, it seemed like forever, was involved in the city council. I don't think that's accurate, but it seemed like he was. But he was always a person who would take a couple of the kids down to a place called Higgins Bar, which is no longer there in Helena. It's burned down. And he would park, usually my brother and I, but it could have been my sister and I too, in the front, you know, at mid-morning, and gets a hot dog and a milkshake. And he'd go in the back. Not to drink, not to gamble, but he went back there with kind of the town folks who drove everything that went on in the town and got information. And he'd be back there about an hour and come back out and say, well, let's go. And I don't think it helped him personally. I don't think it helped him in his business, in insurance business, anything like that. I just think it was a way of sharing information and figure out what was going on in town. And it was also a way to help drive policy in town and what kids were doing and things like that. So that's kind of was a typical Saturday that I remember growing up. And then as we got a little older, you know, sports and other activities, skiing and golf and those kind of lifelong sports, we were always engaged in. But early on, I remember going to Higgins, and that became kind of a, not a watering hole issue, because it was a bar, but a place to go get information and share information and have a cup of coffee. I don't ever remember going in the back, so I haven't a clue what went on back there. I mean, maybe they were drinking. I don't think so. And he would always come out after about an hour and say, well, let's go. We got to go back home.
So you spent a lot of time kind of with your brothers and sisters?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we did. My mother never worked really much when we were growing up. So she was always home when we came home from school. We would walk home from the Catholic school because it was only about 10 or 11 blocks away, which was Bishop Gilmore at the time and then turned into Helena Central. And she would always be there when we came home, which in today's world is almost unheard of. And so we just got by. We did a lot of stuff that didn't cost money at the time. And so Saturdays were always absorbed with stuff like that.
That's cool. And you mentioned some sports. Were you pretty into sports when you were younger?
Oh, I think all of us were. Although my sisters at the time, you know, Title IX wasn't here, so they didn't have women's sports then. Mm-hmm. But my brothers and I were always active in sports. My other brothers were good athletes. They were very good in basketball and football. But yeah, we were always active in those kinds of things growing up. And, you know, as everything that happens, you know, Little League occurred two blocks down at the field. And so my father and the neighborhood fathers coached everybody. And, you know, that went on in the summer. And it's not like it is today. It just went on in the summer. But I'll tell you, it was a fascinating life. But we always... Quite seriously, we always went over to Butte or Anacon a couple times in the summer, whether we wanted to or not, even as we got older. It was just kind of one of those mandatory things that later in life we groused about, but it wasn't necessarily negotiable with my mother.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Well, with five kids, how did the family get around?
You know, we always had new cars. I don't know how the hell Dad did it. I mean, maybe it was the insurance business that he figured out how to get new vehicles. But he would just pile them all in, and we would move around, yeah. I mean, it's just, we only had one car. There weren't two or three cars as you see today. And by the way, in our world, at least with the Butte side, as I said, we would go there because my Butte relatives, some didn't have a car, some didn't have a phone at the time. And so once in a while, we would go over there and bring the car over and haul their kids around to various places, but somehow we got around. I don't know how we did it. We only had one car.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned you're still in touch with some friends from growing up. What are they up to these days?
You know, that's an interesting question. I mean, just this past weekend, I was down in Arizona because the Grizzly football team played Northern Arizona, and I ended up meeting up with a friend of mine that I've been friends with since first grade. He lives in Portland. He's very successful. Has a concrete finishing business. It's a big company. I can almost tell you universally, the friends I grew up with in their own right are all successful. One's a managing editor at the Great Falls Tribune. One's a deputy attorney general. One's a author not just Montana author, by the way, but a national author. I mean, it's really interesting to see how people in their own right became very successful. I don't think to this day that we take each other seriously because of titles, though. Mm-hmm. I think we take each other as either friends or neighborhood pals or high school, grade school pals. And we still refer to each other by the names we refer to as kids. I mean, people to this day call me Jimmy. I know exactly where they're from the neighborhood. They call my brother Danny. My sister to this day refers to herself in Montana as Kathleen Foley McCarthy. I mean, she can do that, but she calls herself Foley as much as she does her married name, McCarthy. The neighborhood was important to me. I still see people to this day, and almost instantly we catch up. Instantly.
What do you think that is? Besides stepping away from the Irish connections, what do you think that Montana connection does for people? Or where have you seen it kind of stand out?
Well, I think, I don't know that it's generational, but I do think neighborhoods are different, and so people are busy. Technology takes care of that to this day. People are busy because there's more activities for kids and their parents, and that's not a criticism. It's just the way life goes. But when I was growing up in the neighborhood, and my cousins were growing up in Butte and Anaconda, many of the things we did didn't cost anything. Very few organized sports at the time, outside of school, and so we had to make our own fun. We had to interact and do things that were just in the neighborhood, whether it be stickball or just hanging out. There weren't movies. We didn't have that kind of thing, and so we were obligated to make our own fun and appreciate the friendships that we had just for hanging out. So I don't think it's generational. I just think there's more things to do in the 21st century than there were, 20 years ago or 30 years ago or 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. what can you tell me about Kevin Shannon?
Kevin Shannon was a very dear friend of my father's, and somehow or another our families became close. But Kevin and my dad, I think, were involved in the insurance business, life insurance business, and that's where they first met. But they realized they had some common interests in terms of my mother being from Butte and my father being from Anaconda. Kevin has a couple of children that are special children, special kids. Well, they're adults now, and my father took a great interest in helping him with those issues when they were institutionalized. To this day, if I see Kevin, he always brings up things about my dad that I probably didn't know about. He's always very complimentary, and it's one of those things that I think in life, they didn't know each other when they were younger, but they became friends in an interesting way as they were older. And while they didn't stay in touch via phone, but they would see one another regularly, and have coffee or have soup and talk about their families and. It was one of those things that was interesting for me as a kid growing up to watch because I'm not sure I really understood the Irish connections at the time. I obviously do now, but I think it was really important. And I can tell you, Kevin, when my father passed away 5 years ago, Kevin came over to the funeral service, and I'll bet to this day he goes to very few of them. And he was in his own way emotional about it because it was a passing of a generation of some of his friends of his generation that were no longer there. Mm-hmm. And I can remember vividly the day after the day of the service that he was not the same Kevin Shannon, because I think he was reflecting on his life and the life of his pals that were going by the wayside.
And can you just kind of for some cohesiveness, just kind of tell us about a little bit about him himself, what he's...
From my memory of Kevin, he's been involved with New York Life Insurance forever. I think he did okay with it, but I think he was always, in my experience, always looking out for the underdog. It wasn't that he did things at the expense of people who were successful, but he wanted people to get an extra step forward. And he was always careful to mention that somebody needed a lift, or somebody needed a few bucks, or somebody needed a van, or somebody needed a washing machine, and those are the conversations I remember having with my father. And the interesting thing about it is, with somebody like Kevin Shannon, is I'm convinced he did most of that anonymously, and probably most people don't know what he did to help others out. Not because of his situation, or not because he had the wherewithal to do it. It just was the right thing to do. And I remember those conversations, kind of listening to them from afar to hear Kevin and my father talking. And, you know, I don't know whatever came out of them, but I'll bet they helped a heck of a lot of people when they needed a helping hand. And I don't think Kevin's ever forgot that. I mean, to this day, I don't think he's forgot that.
That's cool. That's great. Do you, what do you know about Joe Reber?
Joe Reber. You know, Joe Reber, I mean, his family, his kids were slightly older than me, most of them. And so his family, sons and daughters, interacted a little bit with my older brother and sister. But, you know, my memory of Joe Reber was when I was growing up, and I do remember this even as a 7-8-year-old in 1960, he brought then Senator John Kennedy to Helena and had a little function over at his house over on the west side of Helena. And I don't recall if my mother and father went there. I'm not sure they were at that level. But, you know, after that, you begin to find out about who this man was. And he really is a person who started out with zero as a paper boy, selling papers, by the way, in front of the Finland Hotel, which he ended up owning one day, and made himself into, you know, a very successful businessman without even a college or a high school degree. And the University of Montana gave him an honorary doctorate some years ago before I came here, but Joe was a guy who worked hard, got some contracts that my history of it is, you know, installing missile silos around the country, including Montana, at a time when they were putting them all in, and he did well by that. And so this became this big company where he had his own plane and he had multiple people working for him. But politically, I mean, I've always been intrigued by this, even up till a month or so before he passed away when I went and saw him out at the home here in Missoula. He could recall vividly people he interacted with, from John Kennedy to Bill Clinton. And he was a huge Democrat and never was shy about telling elected officials what they should do or shouldn't do. And a big supporter. He always understood that you know, progressives were better off than conservatives. I don't say that in a bad way. He just came from a different world. And even up till the month before he passed away, he gave me his book and signed it. And I didn't read it, by the way, until I got in the car. And it really, really just took my breath away. He signed it to me, but he talked about how good of a guy my dad was. And they probably had their ups and downs in life. I don't know. My dad was on city council and mayor, so they probably had something they went back and forth on. But he always remembered my mom and dad and who they were and who the kids were. And it was just fascinating to talk to him because he would recall vividly not only his life, but the elected officials he interacted with. And, you know, at one point he was in the state Senate. And I think he was appointed, if I recall correctly. And frankly, because of Joe Reber, and others can say what they want about this and take credit for it, the two-year college of technology system was established in Montana. He's the one who created that. And I think he writes about it in his book. But people should be proud of going into two-year systems and getting, you know, a two-year associate degree or getting a certificate for welding. He's the one who created that. Because of where he came from, by the way, because he was a plumber. And he always used to remind me of that when I came back to university. Don't let people forget about it. I'm like, well, I won't. Don't worry, Joe. I'm not going to let people forget. So there you go, Joe. I'm just reminding him one more time.
I'll let him get away with this one, huh? Can you kind of relay your story about Aunt Noni?
Aunt Noni?
Aunt Noni, yes.
Well, my mother had a great aunt in Ireland, which her kids are still around in Ireland and still have some ownership with a family home over there. But my Aunt Noni came to the United States and came to Butte and Helena a couple of times when I was younger. I don't remember her much coming when I was older. But every year, like clockwork, she would send cards to the kids and the family and to my mother, along with candy, which probably was 2 months old at the time because, you know, however they shipped at the time, there wasn't FedEx or UPS, there wasn't any of that. I remember how my mother would always be very emotional about that because it was that connection back to not only Butte but back to Ireland. And she would always talk to us about, you know, I'd like you to have some of this candy because it's from Ireland. You know, I'm not sure, by the way, it made any difference, but we'd always choke it down. And then we lost touch after my mother got sick and passed away. And so I haven't been in touch with Noni or her kids in probably the last decade or so. But I think some of my siblings have. But that was always our connection to Ireland, that at Christmas or on occasion of another holiday or so, we get a package with a note to my mother and the kids mm-hmm. in terrible handwriting. So I don't really know much more about her than that. But the good news is my mother and father, particularly my mother, years before she got sick, had the opportunity to go to Ireland, go to the family homestead, see Aunt Noni, see her great aunt, see some of her second, third cousins, and be at the family home and stay overnight there. And you know, that does my heart good.
What was her response to that? Did you get to talk with her about that trip?
Well, she not much. She complained about it being cold in the house because they still, you know, heated with peat moss. She complained about the stink, and she complained that they made Mom and Dad pay for everything when they went out to dinner, which I thought, well, that didn't matter. I mean, that's not unusual. That happens to this day. But she didn't really talk much about it because I don't know why. She just, I mean, it was important to her that she went, important to my father, kind of less so, and she was proud of it, but she didn't really talk. Had lots of pictures. Didn't really talk about it much. I don't know why that is. I really don't.
That's interesting.
Swap out the battery here.
Battery, kids and your fancy cameras.
Yeah, sorry.
Oh, no, it's fine. I was riding over here today. It was definitely crisp. But
on your bike?
Yeah, but the leaves were just raining down, though. It's always kind of fun to ride up and down.
I shouldn't tell you this. I got in my truck in my garage, which is not heated. Oh. And had the heat on when I left because I was cold. You're on your bike. Holy mackerel.
Oh, it's fine. I just live a few blocks away. It's
wakes you up.
Yeah, definitely. But
wakes you up.
I was, after that first hard frost, I love how the leaves just give up. But I mean,
they're done.
Just
a touch of a breeze, they're gone.
So that's always fun.
Okay, we're good. How are we doing on time for you?
Good. Probably another 10 minutes.
Okay. Sure thing.
If that works for you guys.
No, that's great. Yeah, we'll give you some time. Perfect. Let's hear you back on.
I'm good to go.
Okay. Just kind of a few more things here, and then I'd love to kind of give you a chance to just kind of discuss, if you want to kind of keep that in mind. But did your family have any sayings at all, any kind of very Irishy things that would seem to happen you remember or can connect with?
You know, I don't know if this is an Irish thing, but it is a Butte thing. I can tell you this. My mother, growing up, and even as adults, when we would as kids start to lip off or have some challenges in terms of being knuckleheads or whatever, she had this saying, which I've heard from others over in Butte, not just in the Irish world, but mostly in the Irish world, that she would say, she would wait for us to give our I'm sorries and things like that, and she would always say something to the effect of, you know, I have a pocket full of those I'm sorries, and so let me be self-reflective on your behalf. And when that would happen, I mean, literally, we'd be like, oh my God. I mean, it's going to be worse than a beating, because you're not going to get a beating. Your mother's going to give you a talking to, whether you're a child or an adult. And third, now you've hurt her. And by the way, I don't know that that was universal to her, because I've heard it from my buddies in Butte. Art Noonan's father used to say it once in a while. I hear my cousins say it kind of in different formats once in a while. But and there's probably a few others, but that's one I vividly remember, because even as an adult, it came up. And I use it once in a while with students when they come in here, and they start to give me some answers that I'm like, really, I'm not buying it. And I'll say that. And 7 times out of 10, they'll be like, I'm not sure what that means, but it's not good, whatever it is. And that's the one I remember the most. I mean, there's a typical Butte things that I can't really say because I'm not from Butte, so people would be offended. You know, G-Jet, you know, those kinds of things that are Butte sayings that aren't me. I mean, I didn't hear them that much except when I went to Butte or Anaconda. Mm-hmm. But the one I just told you about my mother, I vividly remember that. Growing up, I vividly remember that.
What was your? You talked about how what your cousins thought of you guys from Helena. What was your view of these rambunctious?
Oh hell, we were afraid of them.
Yeah.
By the way, most of them were girls. I mean, and, you know, so we'd go over there. I'm not exaggerating. We'd go over there and roll out of the car, and within a minute, they'd be taking us to the ground and having a little conversation. They were tough. Still are today. I'm kind of afraid of them a little bit today, to this day. But, you know, they're still loyal on both sides of the family. We still interact when we see one another and catch up a little bit and find out where our cousins are or their siblings. You know, do we stay in touch a bunch? No. And various members of my family stay in touch with them more than others. But, oh, yeah, hell yeah, we were afraid of them. Yeah, and you know how it is in that day and age. My mother and father would say, "Get out there and have at it with them." And I'd be like, "Geez, I just took a beating yesterday. I don't need another one." Yeah, no, we were afraid of them. I probably still am to this day.
That's great. Do you have any? Was food, you know, either Irish food or just particular kind of food? What was your kind of culinary life growing up?
You know, that's a. I'm glad you asked that question. I was thinking about that. So when I was growing up, We ate no vegetables other than out of a can, ever, never fresh. I don't ever remember it. My mother alive today, she'd probably kick my butt, but I don't ever remember it. I don't remember that we ever ate any salad, because either my father or my mother didn't like salad. So we never, you know how to this day you get a salad? That never happened. So we had Jell-O that was our salad, you know, that had fruit in it or something, which to this day I look at and I'm like, oh my God, I'm not eating that. There was always meat of some sort. There was Spam, which even before my father passed away, he ate it like it was hot dogs with fried Spam with cheese. And I just can't even imagine it. And then, you know, even not during Lent, we ate fish on Fridays or tuna fish or tuna casserole. And it to this day, I can't stand even hearing about it, thinking about it. But it was pretty black and white, pretty meat, some potato, some canned vegetable. I mean, in fact, I didn't eat a fresh vegetable in my life. I can't speak to my brothers and sisters until I went to college away. I didn't know what they were. They had Brussels sprouts. I didn't know what it was. I'd never seen them. So yeah, it was pretty basic stuff. Pretty basic stuff. I mean, one time when I was in high school, my dad said to me after a sporting event, "Well, would you like some fruit or something?" I said, "Yeah, I'd like some fruit. I'd absolutely like some." He goes to the store and came back with a brown paper bag. I opened it up. It was a can of fruit cocktail, which to this day I wouldn't eat. So they just had a different view of it, different view of life. They really did. But never a salad, never any vegetable except in a can. And always some fish or tuna or something on Fridays, whether it was Lent or not, which we used to complain about outside of Lent, and my mother would have none of it. We still ate fish sticks, awful, tuna casserole, not good, or some other element that was fish-related.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. What about on holidays or during Lent? Was there any big changes?
No big changes, really. I mean, during Lent, you know, we... because we, at least the older kids, went to Catholic school, so during Lent you went to church quite often. I don't remember every day, but maybe it was that, you know, certainly on Fridays. And then at holidays, particularly at Easter, you know, you would be involved Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and whatever the events are that were going on in the church. All of us growing up were active in altar boys. You know, at the time, young girls couldn't become altar, whatever they call them today. I don't know what they call them today. Helpers, I guess. And so we would serve Mass early in the morning usually, but holidays were usually based around whatever's going on at the church, and that kind of drove our schedule. You know, midnight Mass on Christmas, we always went. My father was a member of the Knights of Columbus, and so they were always active at midnight Mass with their unis and swords and hats and all that, which my little brother's involved with the Knights of Columbus. I hope he's not wearing those uniforms, but maybe he is. But I don't remember thinking anything specifically with food, really, as you asked. I think it was pretty standard.
Was there anything when you'd get together with the family in Butte, any kind of food stuff?
Well, you know, even as young kids, and it's to this day it's the same, we'd go to Butte and either one of two things would come up for one of the meals, either pork chop sandwiches that we would make or go get, or pasties, which we either made or went and picked them up. And to this day, if I go to Butte, I'll go get a pork chop sandwich if I can do it. To this day, every couple of months, Thank God in Missoula they have a place, Lisa's Pasties, where they're from Butte, by the way. We go get pasties, and I have them. I am a little concerned, though, that they now make vegetarian pasties, so I'm not sure how that fits. It wouldn't have fit back then, but that was always the standard. One of those two items we'd have when we went to Butte. Anaconda was more pasties, not pork chop sandwiches. But still, pretty basic food. I don't remember much elaborate. I don't remember much going out to dinner with cousins and all that. We always did it at home. I don't remember that much.
Vegetarian pasties. do you have anything of your folks, any mementos or keepsakes or anything that you've kind of prize or?
You know, I think, I mean, when my mother and father passed away with five kids, we were very careful about, you know, where military medals went, where wedding rings went, where Bibles and rosaries went, so that every child had some of that. But I think the thing that we did is, in my case too, in terms of mementos, I ended up with a jacket that my father had after he'd gone to Carroll, and it wasn't a letter jacket, but it was a jacket that had Carroll College on it, and he used to wear it all the time. And I don't ever wear it, but when I got it, and I'll never forget this, in fact, this is what probably had as much to do with his death as anything. He had a pack of smokes in the cigarette, and or a pack of smokes in the pocket that he was, he probably went and put it on, went outside and had a smoke once in a while. And, you know, I left him in there just because I'm not going to wear the coat, so I'm going to just leave him in there every once in a while and go check on it. And all the rest of the kids have some other memento or a piece of furniture or a painting or things like that. But here's the interesting thing my mother did that probably isn't unique of that generation. When my mother passed away, my father passed away, she had spent, you know, the latter part of her life before she got sick putting things in boxes by name. So when she passed away, I had, for example, in my case, you know, spelling bee trophies, and which a little odd because I can't spell today very well. We have spell check on our computer. You know, mementos from Cub Scouts, photos from Cub Scouts, and she segregated those out by each child. And so we got them all at once. They were all personal, but she had taken the time to do all that, and more importantly, saved it all. I mean, she saved boxes of stuff. And so it was kind of cool to get them all when she passed away, my father passed away. I still have them.
What was going through that box for the first time like?
You know, it was, first of all, it was pretty cool that she saved stuff that I frankly had forgotten about. That she actually saved letters that I wrote to her when I went to like camp, you know, Legendary Lodge Camp, which is the Catholic youth camp. I mean, she saved that stuff. So it was kind of fun to go through and be reminded of kind of where you were and where you're at today. But I think more importantly, it allows us the opportunity to pass it along to others. And, you know, I don't think she was unique in her generation in terms of keeping that stuff and giving it back to us later. I don't think any of us knew that she kept it all. But I think that generation was more thoughtful about, I want to be sure that my kids have, you know, memories of their life growing up, not so much about their parents, but what they did. And she kept cards and birthday cards I sent to her, and it wasn't unique. She did that for all my siblings. But it was pretty cool to go through. I mean, I still have them all in a box, and quite literally to this day, every once in a while, we all get down. We all have bad days, not all the time, but I'll go look through it. Because it brings you back, and it brings you back in a place that is not secure. It just brings you back that, you know, tells you we were pretty lucky in the life we've had so far. And I still do that once in a while.
That's great. If you're going to describe what it's like, or the importance of being of Irish heritage in Montana to somebody that wasn't from here or didn't really know about the Butte connection or didn't know any of those kind of things, what kind of points would you maybe bring up?
You know, I think I would make two or three points, probably in this order. I think, first of all, that it doesn't take very long to meet somebody in Montana who has very strong Irish heritage and grew up in not just Anaconda and Butte, but in places where their families made sure they maintain that heritage. and be able to catch up very quickly about common people you know, common businesses you interact with, and old stories about people that you may have heard before or need to be reminded of. I mean, it doesn't take very long. And to this day, you know, if I go to Butte or if I go to Anaconda, after they qualify that your family's from there, they'll start to refer to you as, well, this is, you know, this is Jim Foley from Anaconda, if you're in Anaconda. And every once in a while, I don't want to overstate this, they'll say, this is, you're from Butte. And you know what? I mean, I grew up in Helena, but that's pretty interesting. I think that's unique. And it doesn't take long for people to have a common interest or a common friend or a common business or a common something they did in sports or, and it just happened to me last night at a reception I was at where somebody knew my brother from the Catholic school days. I'd never met this person before. Related stories about my older brother that I'd never heard. Some not good, by the way. So I think that's number one. I think number two, I don't, and we've chatted about this a little bit, I don't think it ever hurts to be reminded about who you are and how you got to where you're at whatever that level is. And I think in the Irish world, in the Montana Irish world, every once in a while it's good to reflect on that and think about it because in my case, many of the opportunities I have had, and I feel very lucky, was because of, you know, friends I had that were friends of my parents or acquaintances of my relatives or and many of the opportunities I've had has been because of that. And I don't take that lightly. I really don't. To this day, I don't take it lightly. You know, on the campus here, I mean, I'm fortunate to be here, but I mean, to this day, I can catch up with people who are involved with Irish studies and in 30 seconds find out what's going on in the Irish world in Boston and other places. And I'm not sure that really matters to most people, but it's pretty unique for me and probably would be for others. So that's what I think.
That's great. Well, sir, we don't take up too much more of your time. But is there, just kind of knowing about the project, is there anything else you want to share? Anything you've been...
I think what I would say about the project... I think it's in some ways long overdue, but it isn't just about Missoula, and it isn't just about Butte or Anaconda. It's about the West and about Montana and how the Irish came here and the difference they made in people's lives, probably to this day. Not at the expense of other cultures, by the way, but I think it's a valuable project to... take the Irish elders, if I may say that, and have them tell their stories so we don't lose track of them for generation after generation. And I think for folks in my generation and even younger, I think it's important for us to remember, you know, others that were involved in the struggle early on to get jobs and get notoriety and remember that a little bit. And it's not in a spiritual way necessarily, but in a way that, you know, thanks them in your own way and says, you know, good for you. We're better off because you all entered our life sometime along the way. So that's what I think.
Great. All righty. Well, good. Well, thank you so much.
Too much? Too little?
You should know it.
Yeah. Perfect. Thank you.
Yeah, I think we got it going just fine. So definitely appreciate
it. You know, I got to tell you, I was going to tell, and I just decided not to. Joel Reber and my dad got crossways. Mm-hmm. At some point in your life, and I don't know when that was, but my dad would say, "That son of a bitch, I don't like him." And Jesus, he's a bicycle Irish, and I'd be like, "Well," and he'd never tell me what it was. It may have been a disrespect thing. I don't know. So then jump ahead, and I wouldn't ask Pat Williams this, but I'll never forget this. So somehow or another, when Pat Williams was running against Ron Marling, when the two members of Congress in Montana, when it was going down to one seat, and I, myself and a couple other guys ran that campaign for Pat in 92.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Somehow Pat did something with Joel Reber. I don't know what it was. And Joe got pissed and held a fundraiser for Ron Marling, a Republican.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was very open about it, put it in the paper. And so Pat wrote this nasty, well, two. First handwritten note, nasty note, sends it out to his executive assistant, Mary Flanagan, and wants to send it to Joe. And Mary was always good about it. Jim, would you just take a look at this? Kind of, oh, shit, he can't send that. You know, that'll be in the papers. So I go back in, and we had one of three or four terse conversations in my life with him. He's like, I don't care. I could give a shit. I'm like, no, you don't.